Can this be considered a turning point for Israelis? After the October 7th attack by Hamas, the nation put aside bitter differences. But after the killing of six Israeli hostages, cue the biggest protest since last year's attempted judicial overhaul by Benjamin Netanyahu's hard-right government. Demonstrators accuse a prime minister of piling on the demands to extend a war that's become his ticket, they say, to staying in power. Not at all, insists Netanyahu. He's doubling down over his decision to now prioritize the occupation of the Philadelphia corridor between Gaza and Egypt. All this while pushing back against growing pressure from allies. He's branded as a shameful the UK's decision to suspend certain arms export licenses. What's the plan in London and Washington? What's the plan for Netanyahu? Can he lead a divided nation in a war that's also involving more and more the West Bank and the Lebanese border? For all the protests, does he still have the support he needs to keep going? Today in the France 24 debate, we're asking about the pressure surrounding those hostages. With us in this edition, we'll be joined shortly by France 24 correspondent Iris Mockler from London. Naomi Bar-Yaakov, associate fellow at the think tank Chatham House. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
From Tel Aviv, Israeli-Palestinian peace activist Shahad Bishara of the Standing Together Movement. Welcome to the show. As you speak, we're seeing live images of a nightly rally that's getting underway where you are in Tel Aviv.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
And from Washington, Khaled El-Gindi, director of the Middle East Institute's Palestinian-Israeli Affairs Program. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
You can listen, like, and subscribe to the France 24 debate on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other fine streaming services. No one is more committed to freeing the hostages than me, the words of Benjamin Netanyahu earlier this Tuesday. Try telling that, though, to the thousands, including Israel's president, who a day earlier attended the funeral of 23-year-old Israeli-American Hirsch Goldberg Polan. For international audiences, his parents had become the face of the ordeal of families, meeting with the likes of Joe Biden and Pope Francis. Meeting with them, it turns out, in vain.
Okay, sweet boy, go now on your journey. I hope it's as good as the trips you dreamed about, because finally, my sweet boy, finally, 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 you're free. I will love you and I will miss you every single day for the rest of my life. But you're right here. I know you're right here. I just have to teach myself how to feel you in a different way. And Hirsch, there's one last thing I need you to do for us. Now I need you to help us stay strong. And I need you to help us survive.
Naomi Bar-Yaakov, is the outpouring that we saw on Monday something of a turning point?
Yes, I think it is a turning point. There's been a build-up. There have been various turning points. I think the vast majority of the Israeli population believes that Prime Minister Netanyahu has. They believe that he's responsible for the Hamas killing of the six hostages. That he is the person who's been obstructed. One other in the mediators, Qatar, US, working painstakingly for 11 months to try to secure a deal. Both Hamas leader Yahya and Prime Minister Netanyahu had their moments in which they have changed their stance. However, Prime Minister Netanyahu has time and time again added conditions after the agreement that new Hamas would not be able to live with.
Not be able to live with. Naomi, apologies, but the audio quality is a little bit sketchy still. So what we're going to do is we're going to call you right back. Apologies for that and reconnect. Hopefully it will be better. But to pick up on the point you're making, Netanyahu saying, no one will preach to me on this issue. Those were his words this Tuesday. Netanyahu now insists there cannot be a ceasefire deal without control of that Philadelphia corridor. Emerald Maxwell has more.
In front of a room full of journalists, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu pled his case for why he wouldn't give up Israeli control of the so-called Philadelphia corridor in order to reach a ceasefire deal.
The axis of evil needs the Philadelphia corridor, and for that reason, we must control the Philadelphia corridor. Hamas insists for that reason that we not be there, and for that reason, I insist that we be there.
14 kilometers long and 100 meters wide, on the southern edge of the Gaza Strip bordering Egypt and including the Rafah crossing, the Philadelphia corridor was a demilitarized zone before Israel seized it in May as it expanded its Gaza ground offensive. Israeli troops have since uncovered tunnels there they say have been used to smuggle weapons and ammunition into Gaza. But as part of a ceasefire deal, Hamas has long demanded a complete Israeli withdrawal from the Strip, while Egypt objects to Israeli military presence on the border. Netanyahu's comments came at the end of a day of nationwide protests in Israel. The recovery of the bodies of six hostages in Gaza on Sunday has fueled anger and growing accusations that the prime minister was looking for excuses to prolong the war.
This time it's the Philadelphia corridor, which is really very insignificant in the broader context of the war between us and the Hamas in Gaza. All these security experts, all the generals, all the heads of Mossad, of the Secret Service, they all say we can pull out, and if at some point in the future there will arise a need to react against the Philadelphia corridor, we will be able to do it.
Analysts say that what's at stake is really Netanyahu's political survival, which depends on placating his far-right coalition partners, whose parties reject any concessions to reach a deal.
As promised, we can now join France 24 correspondent Iris Makler in Jerusalem. Iris, you heard in that report former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert saying that the Philadelphia corridor is, quote, insignificant when it comes to the overall military picture. Is that the general consensus this Tuesday?
I tell you what the consensus is. The consensus is that Netanyahu has raised this very late in the piece. If it was so vital, why wasn't the Philadelphia corridor the first place that Israel went to at the beginning of October when it attacked Gaza? Why wasn't it the first location? Second of all, why did they wait till May to do that? And we heard today from one of the generals, former generals, now a politician who had been in the cabinet at the time, who was saying Netanyahu didn't want to go south. He didn't want to expand the Gaza war. They had to persuade him to do that. So if all of that is right, then why is the Philadelphia corridor suddenly so vital? And yes, there are other, we hear from a number of sources, not just from the defence minister, Yoav Gallant, but from a number of military people who say that if Israel, let's just take the first phase of this deal, Israel pulls out for 6 weeks, there's no reason it can't return. That 6 weeks is not vital to any military operation, whereas it is vital for the hostages, the hostages who remain alive at the moment.
And militarily, Iris, if Israel is a house divided, can he continue fighting?
That's a very, very good question. I heard someone saying today, a relative of one of the hostages or in that camp, who said, you know, if we don't do this now, if we don't go and rescue our hostages, then who's going to enlist in the army if they know that if they do get taken hostage or taken captive, no one's going to go back and try and get them? You know, part of the ethos of Israel and the Israeli military has always been we all stand together, nobody's left behind. And here people are being left behind, and they're not even soldiers. They were people who were taken from their beds on the 7th of October, some of them still in their pyjamas and without shoes. So they were civilians in the purest sense of the word, and they're not being retrieved or rescued either. Some are being retrieved, of course, bodies are being retrieved, but live hostages are not being rescued. So time is of the essence, and the Israeli ethos, people really do feel that sense of unity is under threat.
Shad Bishara, the last two nights when you've been in Tel Aviv, is it a sense that you were back to the same mood that existed before October 7th when Israel was bitterly divided over this judicial overhaul?
Actually, the overall picture that we witnessed in the last 2 days is actually very, very, it's stronger in the judicial. Back then, we didn't see a 500,000 of people going out to the streets. And we saw yesterday and 2 days ago that actually hundreds of thousands, these numbers were not witnessed back then. That's first of all. Then second of all, I think there is kind of awakening in the Israeli society, this awakening that actually shows that no more military operation or no more military pressure can bring back the hostages alive. And therefore, the only way to ensure bringing back the hostages alive is through a deal and through a ceasefire agreement. Until 2 days ago, people actually were doubting whether it is correct to continue the war or not. But a critical point that we are witnessing right now in the Israeli society is actually showing that they starting realizing that there is the military pressure actually brings the hostages dead. The Philadelphia corridor is kind of Netanyahu way to run away from a hostage deal, because as we know, in Biden's framework of the deal, the Philadelphia corridor was not mentioned at all. And then suddenly this is what's gonna save the people or ensure the people's security. And I think it actually ensures only Netanyahu's survival in this extremist far-wing government.
But he's still got that majority in parliament, Shad. So at the end of the day, he can resist the pressure, right?
At the end of the day, he can. I think the situation right now that it is a dead end. I mean, he knows that the pressure actually can make his government collapse, and eventually we will have a new election, and he will eventually lose his power. I mean, he can try to survive as much as he can, but people actually are realizing, actually against his aggressive policies, against his the lack of transparency in his managing the situation militarily mainly.
Khaled El-Gindi, I don't know if you brought a crystal ball to this conversation, but certainly if we take a step back, rather, where do you think the tipping point would come from when we saw how brutal the war was a few months back, how there wasn't any more ceasefires after November? Where did you think the tipping point would come? Would it come from abroad, or would it come from domestic politics?
That's a good question. I mean, I think either one at this point could tip the balance, one or both of them. Certainly the kind of protests we're seeing now in Israel, we have not seen throughout the war after almost a full year. It may not be enough in the end, because Netanyahu has been able to manipulate his political opposition. He's been able to neutralize that opposition, and he's managed to stay in power this long. And I think he's defied all the odds in doing so. And he's managed also to forestall any commission of inquiry into the failures of October 7th. So he's really been quite successful at engineering his ability to remain in power. And it's not clear whether simply, massing in the streets will be enough to bring down the coalition. Obviously, it will take a vote by the Knesset to do that. It's not clear that they have the votes. But there's another path to pressuring Netanyahu, and that is the international community, and especially the United States. The Biden administration has made clear many times publicly that there is nothing more to be gained from Israel's military operation, that the framework for a ceasefire is in place and only needs to be signed and implemented. And yet Netanyahu has defied the United States at every stage. And the United States has also ensured that Netanyahu had the ability to do the very things that they didn't want him to do, like invade Rafah, like escalate in the West Bank now, to continue using humanitarian crisis and starvation as a weapon. These are all things that the United States has warned Israel not to do, but it continues to supply the weapons for Israel to do those things. And so there is a leverage that is not being used by the Biden administration in particular. If they genuinely wanted this war to end, they could do so, but it would require paying a domestic political cost in the case of President Biden, which he has not wanted to do.
Yeah, and I want to get back to that point with you a little bit later on, but just harking back to your first point, the fact that over the past 11 months, Benjamin Netanyahu has proved solid in the art of political survival. In remarks on Monday, Israel's prime minister did ask for forgiveness after the killing of those six hostages. Let's take a listen.
I told the families, and I repeat it again tonight, I ask for your forgiveness for not bringing them back alive. We were close, but we didn't succeed.
Iris Makler, remember at the beginning of the war when there was a complaint that Netanyahu had not issued a formal apology for failures to prevent October 7th? Was that the apology there?
No, it wasn't, for two reasons. One is he has not taken responsibility for the events of October the 7th till this day. In fact, in his press conference last night, he referred to it as October the 9th. And a lot of people were saying on Twitter, perhaps he thinks that's when he became prime minister, so he doesn't have to take any responsibility for Israel's greatest catastrophe for many years, certainly going back at least 50 years. So it isn't an taking of responsibility. It was a slightly, you know, it did follow the president at Hirsch Goldberg Polin's funeral apologising, and perhaps his advisers told him he should make an apology as well. And he said, we didn't get there in time, which is an interesting way to phrase it, because this wasn't a rescue mission. They stumbled upon these bodies, not far from where they stumbled upon the last hostage to be rescued alive, Farhan al-Qadi, about a week ago. So they were operating in those tunnels, that's the Israeli military, and they found the bodies. They weren't there on a rescue mission. So, you know, yes, it's true, he did apologise, but not all the families accepted that apology, because he was making condolence visits today, and the wife of one of the hostages killed, so one of those six who were returned and was being buried, she refused to hear him or see him.
Yeah, Netanyahu blowing hot and cold. He also brands as shameful the UK's decision to suspend some arms export licenses, a decision justified by the new Labour government of Keir Starmer.
We've suspended the export licenses on 30 out of 350 parts. These are ones that could be a clear risk in breaching international law in Gaza. But our determination to stand with Israel remains resolute and absolute.
All right, we've reconnected by the magic of telephones with Nomi Bar-Yaakov in London. Nomi, were you surprised by that announcement from the UK government?
No, not at all. I think it's been coming. I've been stating it's been coming for some time. We have a new government. We have a new Attorney General, Richard Hermer. We have advice that the previous government had refused to make public, but it was pretty clear that the advice had stated that they are suspecting that, that Israel is violating international humanitarian law. And the UK is concerned about its own role in complicity. So I think they are, which is an international law issue, and there is a problem there. So they suspended 30 out of 350 export licenses for arms. And I think that's the beginning. And I think the trend will increase as long as the war increases. And I think other countries will follow the UK.
And let me ask you, Nomi, the Conservative opposition saying the timing of this announcement is wrong. It's not the right time to be doing it. Where does public opinion lie where you are?
I think it's never the right time. You know, it's sort of, it maybe even late. The right time would have been a long time ago. And I think public opinion, by and large, lies with David Lammy, the secretary, the foreign secretary's decision and announcement that he made yesterday to suspend 30 export licenses.
Now, Britain exports 1% of Israel's weapons. The United States, 69%. There, the commander-in-chief's patience seems to be wearing thin. Let's listen to Joe Biden speaking Monday.
Are you planning to present a final hostage deal to the both sides this week?
We're very close to that.
Mr. President, do you think it's time for Prime Minister Netanyahu to do more on this issue? Do you think he's doing enough?
No.
No. And that's all he had to say more on that. Let me ask you, Khaled El-Gindi, picking up on what you were saying earlier. First of all, what is this final hostage deal?
Well, I mean, it's almost bizarre to hear the words final hostage deal. I mean, we've been told for the past 9 or 10 months that we're on the verge of clinching a deal. It's just around the corner, just over the horizon. And we never quite get there. And so I find it hard to believe that if this last push by the this latest push by the administration to get a ceasefire deal, that they will simply call it quits and say, well, there's no deal to be had. I think that would be very unsatisfactory to the American public, certainly to Israelis and Palestinians and others in the region. And it would be a very bad look for the United States. So I think the push, the current push looks a lot like the previous ones in that there is a lot of cajoling. There's a lot of wordsmithing. But at the end of the day, there's a refusal to kind of accurately diagnose the problem. And the consensus, certainly on this panel, but I think internationally, is that the single greatest obstacle to a ceasefire deal is the person of Benjamin Netanyahu himself. I mean, he has thwarted agreements time and again. He's added new conditions. He's escalated through assassinations, through escalating on the Northern Front with Lebanon, through most recently in the last week, attempting to blow up the West Bank in a similar way that they have in Gaza. So he's never missed an opportunity to try and escalate and undercut a ceasefire. I think it behooves the president of the United States to call it as it is, the way the rest of the world sees it.
And let me ask you this. Let me ask you, Khaled.
Kind of wishful thinking,
Will Kamala Harris be any different from Joe Biden?
Well, I don't think Kamala Harris wants to inherit this problem. If we're still negotiating a ceasefire in January of 2025, that would be a massive failure. That would essentially be the legacy of Joe Biden, of failed U.S. diplomacy. But I do think Kamala Harris has shown signs that she would have a different approach. There's only so far she's willing to go to diverge from the president, since she is, after all, the sitting vice president and has to stay within the four corners of the official Biden policy. But I think she's given a number of indications that that she would have a different approach, that she's not going to necessarily give Netanyahu such a free hand and a blank check the way Joe Biden has. But she's also, I think, just talked about the issue in much more human terms, something that Joe Biden has really struggled with, something as basic as acknowledging Palestinian humanity or expressing empathy with Palestinians. That's not something Joe Biden has been able to do, but it's something that Kamala Harris, at least, has done, at least rhetorically. And I think that is one of the signs that I think suggests that she will probably have a different approach.
Shad Bashar, your thoughts on this, and what can move the needle?
What can move the needle actually is nothing but to change direction. Change direction in means of, we have been always hearing, I mean, for decades, managing the conflict, and we know that the core problem of the conflict is actually the occupation, the siege, and the military control over millions of Palestinians in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, as well as the being inside of Israel, being classified as Class B citizens. I mean, the ideology of the Jewish supremacy, this is what actually needs to be treated first in order to actually move the needle. Moving the needle, I mean, with the current situation in Gaza is actually we're seeing it in the West Bank recently, and we are facing it ourselves as the Palestinian citizens of Israel in a way of silencing, arresting, as well as firing from our job. So the core problem is actually to solve and to get a resolution, a diplomatic resolution for the conflict itself, and not managing the conflict and putting the occupation on the side and showing that everything is fine. No, everything is not fine unless we actually get a just peace that ensures security and freedom for all who lives in this land between the river and the sea.
Shad Bashar, you heard Iris Makler describing the shock of what was the biggest attack on Israel in half a century. Nearly 11 months on, are there people that you find from your personal experience, more people willing to talk about what you've just described, longer-term solutions?
I mean, people are aware right now that the core problem is not only the event, the tragic event of the 7th of October. I mean the whole history of this area actually is the tragic for everyone.
But is it as impossible today to talk about that as it was at the end of October?
I don't think it's impossible, but actually, I think that somehow we need to build the trust again between both sides. And this is the problem right now, building trust again after what happens in the 7th of October, and actually building trust after what the Palestinians have been endured.
Iris Makler with Hindsight, speaking on the first Tuesday in September. All those times that Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, has been to Israel and talked about the day after, how do they ring?
See, that's the interesting question, and that was going through my mind as I was listening to Benjamin Netanyahu last night. Let's say you take his strategic assessment as correct, and Israeli troops must remain in the Philadelphia corridor. That was it. There was nothing further. There was nothing about, you know, what happens next? What happens next with the hostages? Will there be a deal in that case? What happens next with Gaza? What's the plan for Gaza? That, there hasn't been that for the entire war. And that's why that lack of a strategy has been something that I think almost every military leader, former general, security service person you speak to, that's what they all talk about. You know, you can keep fighting, you can have a forever war, but what comes after and what's your vision? And there was no vision from Netanyahu, and I guess that goes back to the original point. You need a forever war if you want to be a forever prime minister. You're not going to have any resolution to all these issues if you're not aiming for a resolution. And that includes a two-state solution, and that includes looking back and seeing what brought, how these two sides got to this point. And that includes some acknowledgement from Benjamin Netanyahu of that divide and rule policy of his, which included funding, openly funding Hamas for years. You know, $30 million in cash from Qatar coming in via the Israeli checkpoints to Gaza for Hamas to spend on arms. All those things have to be looked at with a vision for what, who will rule Gaza. Would it be Hamas? Would it be the Palestinian Authority? Who would be on the Rafah checkpoint if Israel were to remain? None of that, no vision of any kind, let alone the further things you've just been discussing, which is how you build trust between two peoples to have some kind of accord again. You know, I have to tell you one thing. Many, many years ago, when I wasn't here as a permanent correspondent, I did an interview with Mohammed Dahlan, of all people, and we asked him, I was there for an interview, and we asked him, what's the future going to bring? And he said, Israel and the Palestinians are going to hell together. And I've been thinking about that a lot since October the 7th, because I feel my job here is to chronicle two peoples who've brought each other to their lowest points ever.
Nomi Baryakov, you work at a think tank. Your job is to think about the day after. Do you find that more Israelis are willing to engage in that conversation?
Yes, I think we're at this turning point where Israelis realize that the fact that there isn't an Israeli official sort of day after plan means that the law, that the war is going to go on and on. And it's only when the end goal is clear and you carve that very clear path with benchmarks towards two states living with full sovereignty in independence side by side, that really one can reach that solution. So, you know, Mohammed Dahlan being based in the UAE, there are, you know, plenty. You have Yasser Arafat's nephew, Nasser al-Kidwa, has just come out with a peace plan, post, you know, day off, including day after, with Ehud Olmert, who you aired earlier in the program, former Israeli prime minister, Likud prime minister. So you have Israelis and Palestinians sitting together and working through back channels. I'm involved in various channels to work out the plan towards the goal that will be security and stability for the whole region, which will include, of course, how will Gaza be governed after Israeli withdrawal, assuming that Israel will not stay in the Philadelphia corridor. The Philadelphia corridor is a 14-kilometer corridor that is part of the Egyptian-Israeli Camp David 1978 accord. Egypt won't allow an Israeli presence there. They won't divert from what has been agreed in the agreement, and they may take a tougher stance. And Netanyahu knows this all too well. So, yes, it is very important, and I think Israelis realize, and they're also demonstrating not for the ouster of Netanyahu, an end of the war, and many of them for an end of the occupation, not all of them.
Khaled Al-Gindi, again, do you see the same uptick in plans to reverse this downward spiral that Iris described?
Well, part of the problem on the Palestinian side is that there is a real lack of leadership. The leadership of President Mahmoud Abbas has simply not been up to the task of responding, of being able to respond to the existential threat that Palestinians face in Gaza as well as in the West Bank. So there's a real failure of vision and leadership on the Palestinian side. That is a gaping hole that will have to be plugged in any kind of day after scenario or future, if there's a future for a two-state solution, you need to have not just people who can govern Gaza, but people on the Palestinian side who can lead, who have a strategic vision. And that is not in place. There are a number of people who are vying for that role. In the event that Abbas passes from the scene, but we're still a long way from that vision.
Iris Machler, there's this question of who speaks with whom.
You know, this is another side effect of the war not ending. People are still traumatized. Israelis are still traumatized by October the 7th because until the hostages come home, it's not actually over. So while the war doesn't end, while the Gaza war doesn't end, while the displacement in the north, that's the north of Israel, the south of Lebanon doesn't end, while this escalation in the West Bank doesn't end, the war's ongoing. And then there's no plans for the day after, certainly not from this government. The people, the who is talking to whom, would not be members of this right-wing extremist government in many ways. And some of them are extremist settlers who don't want to divide the West Bank and don't want a two-state solution. In fact, part of their aim is to return to Gaza. So, you know, they're not a large number or a large proportion of this government, but it does exist, and they're still in power. So while they are the law of the land in Israel, there's no formal discussions. But there are, I have seen Ehud Olmert talking with Nasser al-Kidwe and with another Palestinian leader. I guess the truth is what you need is Israeli elections. What you desperately need is Palestinian elections because it's now, I think, the 19th year possibly the 20th year of President Abbas in his, you know, initially four-year term. So all of these things mean that there's just stasis here. It's paralyzed. And until there's new leadership, I have to say on both sides, you won't have formal discussions, even if you do have back-channel discussions.
And just on that point, Iris, we saw an Israeli news outlet, Channel 12, report that there was a big shouting match inside the cabinet on Sunday between the prime minister and his defense minister over this issue of whether to press over the Philadelphia mm-hmm. corridor. That story, has it gone away?
No.
No, it's part of the ongoing terrible relationship between the Prime Minister and the Defence Minister. The Defence Minister, who is a right winger too, actually, but wasn't born in the Likud, if you like, came from another party. He takes a strategic view, a more strategic view, a more traditional Israeli view. This government is an unusual Israeli government, and it takes a more right-wing extremist view. And so what you have is Netanyahu representing the right-wing extremists in his government, fighting with Gallant, with the defence minister, who stands up against him. And indeed, the Philadelphia corridor, what he was saying, I guess, is what the people on the street are saying, which is there are two aims, stated aims of this war, destroying Hamas and freeing the hostages, and it's time for Israel to prioritise freeing the hostages over the destruction of Hamas. I mean, that's the call from the streets. And in effect, that's what Gallant is saying as well, because he says if you only have a six-week pause, if that's all that's ever agreed or achieved, then you can go back if that's what you need to do militarily. But the hostages don't have that time, that discussion that we've had. So he is putting that reasonable, centrist, still defence-minded view that some right-wing people hold as well, some military people hold as well, but it's not popular in this cabinet.
Not popular in this cabinet, and the panel's been mentioning it, that while the fighting in Gaza has marked a bit of a lull the last couple of days for a round of polio vaccines for children, in fact, the UN Secretary General has said that if you can do it for vaccinating children, why can't you have a proper truce? It's been nearly a week of raids so far in the northern West Bank. There was a 15-year-old Palestinian killed overnight in the city of Tul Karem. Shad Bishar, your thoughts on, again, is it just another sign that it is a forever war that we have on our hands?
Seems like this, the vocals of the extremist fascist the settler government that we are facing right now. I mean, the same policy that we are witnessing in Gaza is moving right now to the West Bank with the excuses, with no meaning or with no aim of what's happening there. But it's actually to the ideology of resettle or reoccupation, as well as the settler ideology that actually leading the area right now. The only way to stop this madness is with different government, but also government that don't put aside the occupation, but rather actually finding a just solution for the occupation.
Naomi Baryakov, the settlers that are part of that coalition, they know that if there is a snap election, they become irrelevant. So are we in an impossible situation?
No, they're not the ones, obviously, that are going to leave the government voluntarily. But what Netanyahu has a majority of 64 in a 120-stronghold Knesset, the Israeli parliament. So you need five that have the conscience to put humanity over their narrow personal political goals. And I think that hopefully it won't be long before five defect to the opposition. The call is from the public is that all of the members of the coalition have blood on their hands, and therefore they should resign. They're not going to resign, but some may defect to the opposition with the hope that they will eventually get re-elected because they did the right thing and prioritized. Finally, after 11 months and many deaths that could have been prevented, that they will actually defect. That is the greatest hope, that the public will finally get to a minimum of five people that will bring down, five members of the coalition that could defect and bring down the government.
A final question. I'll put it to Iris Makler. We're going to look at those live images, Iris, from Tel Aviv. Where, again, for a third night, there are a lot of people out in the streets. An unscientific headcount. Is the protest movement now as big as the one against the judicial overhaul? Yeah.
At different times, you know, we haven't seen these numbers since then. Israelis were reluctant to come out against their government during a war. But the turning point for the people, I think, has been the return of these six hostages killed within, 48 hours before they were found. And I think that's really hit home because there were spontaneous demonstrations on Sunday night. So this is the third night. The question is, is a turning point for the people going to be a turning point for the politicians? And I guess that's what we have to wait and see.
Iris Makler, many thanks for being with us from Jerusalem. Shad Bishara in Tel Aviv, Naomi Baryakov in London, as well as Khaled El-Gindi in Washington. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24.
Thank you very much.